Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on June 27th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, Connecticut Nonprofit Senior Care Provider Sees Fitch Ratings Upgrade to A Stable Outlook. A Connecticut nonprofit senior care continuum had its debt rating upgraded to A Stable Outlook, rated by Fitch Ratings. The change by the credit agency for MasonaCare comes a little more than 2 years after MasonaCare was given a BBP plus with a positive outlook and reflects the positive effects of management's several-year implementation of a revised business model, which reduced its exposure to skilled nursing facility volatility, according to Fitch. According to Fitch, the upgrade reflects the following. Since 2019, cost management metrics have gradually improved with operating ratios in the mid to upper 90% range for fiscal year 2023 compared to 106% in 2019. The balance sheet has grown with cash to adjusted debt increasing to 117% in fiscal 2023 from 78% in 2020. Fitch expects the financial profile to continue to incrementally improve in its forward-looking scenario analysis as MasonaCare continues to focus on improving operating trends. MasonaCare's president and CEO, John Paul Vannoyt, says he credits the continued improvement of the organization to the ongoing strategic adjustments to MasonaCare's diversified statewide portfolio of services. The senior care industry remains challenged due to a variety of key contributors, including the rising cost of goods and services, a pressured labor market, and reductions in state, federal, and managed care reimbursement. The only way to remain sustainable is to implement key strategic initiatives and remain vigilant about that strategy. Vannoyt also said he credits the MasonaCare employee team members and a supportive and forward-thinking board of trustees for the organization's continued momentum. It is the people behind the plan that have brought us to where we are today. Without a team who can implement, a strategic plan is just an idea. We have a talented team of like-minded leaders who share a common vision and are committed to the organization, our residents, and one another. The company noted that Vannoyt joined MasonaCare at age 16, working in dining services and grew through the ranks, and was appointed to president and CEO in 2016 during MasonaCare's fiscal challenges. At the time of JP's appointment, MasonaCare's future looked grim. Dependent on their charity foundation to offset failed operations, MasonaCare was poised to close its door within 7 to 10 years if the company was unable to right-set their financial position. Through a well-crafted plan, inspiring leadership, and extraordinary teamwork, we implemented a year-over-year plan to address the pain points while improving the delivery of care and service. As a result, MasonaCare is poised for growth and service line expansion. Fitch also noted in his posting that MasonaCare's stable operating profile and good demand for services reflects its diversified service lines, strong reputation, and geographic presence throughout much of Connecticut. MasonaCare's operations include 2 senior living communities, a skilled nursing facility, a small acute psychiatric hospital, and a sizable home health agency. MasonaCare provides statewide care and service to more than 4,500 patients and residents. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on June 26. It's written by Luther Termel, and it's titled, Milford Bank Seeks Connecticut Approval to Close Loan Office in New Haven. Milford Bank is asking Connecticut regulators for approval to close the financial institution's commercial loan office in New Haven. Executives with the bank filed their request to close the bank's loan production office at 142 Temple Street on June 11th, according to officials with the Connecticut Department of Banking. Milford Bank officials hope to close the New Haven loan office by July 11th, said Jorge Santiago, the bank's chief operating officer. Santiago said on Monday the closing won't result in any layoffs because the commercial loan officers who meet with clients in that office will be meeting with customers at their place of business or whenever they feel comfortable. We opened this office strictly as a place to meet with commercial loan customers. We found once the pandemic hit, we were meeting less and less with folks in person, and that trend has continued. Santiago said bank customers have become much more comfortable doing Zoom calls or some sort of audiovisual conversation rather than having to make time to leave their business and come see us in person. Even as the use of technology to meet with customers seeking commercial loans increased, the bank has seen its business in New Haven increase in each of the last 4 years. We're still very committed to the New Haven market, and we continue to have business there. The office we have in New Haven is very small, but we didn't feel that we needed it anymore. Milford Bank has 4 branches in Milford and 1 in Stratford. John Carosone, president of the Hartford-based Bank Analysis Center consulting firm, said closing a commercial loan office in favor of using remote meetings is surprising. A commercial loan is much more involved than taking out a mortgage. Business-related loans typically involve a good deal more analysis and underwriting steps than residential mortgages, and hence a personal interface is usually required. But customer behavior has changed, with even business borrowers and lenders being more comfortable with an electronic interface for loan applications. Carosone said another likely factor in Milford Bank's efforts to close the loan office is that it may be generating sufficient business and earning the corporate target rate for return on invested capital. The bank is the 12th largest in New Haven County with only a 1.75% market share and a legal lending limit of roughly $6 million. Therefore, it is facing size, scale, and name recognition issues. Moreover, it has formidable competition in New Haven, including some of the country's largest banks, but also larger community banks such as Liberty Bank. Our next article was published in the Meriden Record Journal on June 26th. It's written by Law Guzman, and it's titled, Meriden Pride Share Airs Concern Over MAGA Facebook Posts. Meriden Pride Chair Brandon Arroyo visited a meeting of the city's Human Rights, Racial Equity, and Social Justice Advisory Board earlier this month to share a concern over what he described as a really odd Facebook post made by one of the board's members. I think that everyone has the right to freedom of speech, and it's great that we have that in this country. But when you are in a position for the community, you should be held to a higher standard. Arroyo referenced Facebook comments made by board member Alan Bissonette on a Meriden Pride rally held at Memorial Boulevard on May 19th to demand the Pride flag fly during the full month of June at the Augusta Curtis Cultural Center. Bissonette posted blurry photos of the Pride rally with superimposed MAGA posters under the caption, Make T-Shirts Great Again, on May 19th in Meriden Talks, a local Facebook group. MAGA standards for Make America Great Again, a campaign slogan used by former President Donald Trump. The post got limited reactions, but Bissonette interacted with those who commented, leaving comments with unclear interpretations, including, I think it's gays for Trump holding a rally, and these panhandlers really getting political lately, in reference to the fact that the monument is a common spot to solicit charity. Bissonette has not responded to the request for comment at the time of publication and declined to comment when given the chance at the meeting. It's unclear if he created the images himself. The people depicted as holding the MAGA signs were attending the rally in support of Pride. Arroyo responded to Bissonette and read excerpts from the board's mission, which includes seeking to uphold civil rights and to eliminate potentially discriminatory practices. In recent months, the board has supported an initiative led by City Councilor Chad Cardillo to fly the Pride flag at the Augusta Curtis Cultural Center. Council also hosted discussions on barriers for the city's LGBTQ plus residents, with Board Secretary Jeff Freiser attending the rally. Addressing Bissonette directly, Arroyo said he was saddened by Bissonette's comments, especially considering his position on the board. You're on this committee to help promote equality in the city, but you go out there and you create discord and sow issues with people and make fun of us for being out there trying to fight for our equality and representation in this city. In response, outgoing Chair Vanessa Hutchins thanked Arroyo for bringing the concern to the council and added that it would have been better if Arroyo shared the concern privately. Hutchins had no further comment except to say that the matter has been discussed and resolved. We should be held to a certain standard, but then again, we're grown and we all have our own opinions, and that's what's something we can discuss further as a committee. The advisory board is on break for the summer, where incoming Chair Enilka Lopez-Riddle will take over for Hutchins. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on June 26. It's written by Peter Yankowski, and it's titled, Connecticut Men Accused of Carjacking NYPD Sergeant at Gunpoint. Two Connecticut men, who authorities say carjacked a New York City police sergeant's personal vehicle at gunpoint this month, are now facing federal charges. Police later recovered both handguns, one of which was modified with an illegal Glock switch, or auto sear, capable of converting a semi-automatic handgun into a machine gun. Waterbury residents Jose Rivera, 20, and Homar Crespo, 21, for each charge with carjacking, using and carrying firearms, including a machine gun, during and in relation to the carjacking, and possessing a machine gun, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. As alleged, armed with a machine gun and semi-automatic handgun, both with extended magazines, the defendants committed a brazen and terrifying act of violence against a member of law enforcement when they stole his car at gunpoint. Whether cop or civilian, anyone victimized by this sort of crime can count on my office to seek swift justice, said U.S. Attorney Damian Williams. The theft unfolded during the evening hours of June 14th in the Harlem section of New York City. The two men approached the New York City Police Department sergeant's car from behind, according to the U.S. attorney. They wore a mask and black clothing. One of the men approached from the driver's side, the other from the passenger side. Both displayed guns at the victim, demanding he turn over his keys. Then they drove off into the area of 138th Street and Broadway. New York City police apprehended the two men after a foot chase. During the chase, both men discarded their guns, which were recovered by officers. One of the firearms was a loaded 40 caliber Glock 27, equipped with what appears to be a Glock automatic switch device. The devices have increasingly been used in shootings in recent years. They allow a semi-automatic gun that fires a single shot per trigger pull to instead fire until the trigger is released, turning the gun into a miniaturized machine gun. They are generally illegal. Machine guns are strictly regulated under federal law. The second gun recovered by police was a 9mm Glock 17 with an extended 30-round magazine. If convicted, the two men face up to life in prison on charge of using a firearm during carjacking, up to 15 years on the carjacking charge, and up to 10 years for possessing a machine gun. The NYPD said last week that officers responded to a robbery in progress at West 146th Street and Bradhurst Avenue around 11:30 p.m. the night of the carjacking, but did not disclose that the victim was a member of the department. Both men were charged under New York state law, including possession of a machine gun, without identifying the specific weapons involved. The news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office clarifies that only one of the guns was modified with a switch. NYPD Commissioner Edward Caban, in a statement, called the crime brazen and said the men's swift arrest should serve as a warning to others that criminal acts in New York City will never be tolerated. Our next article was posted to the ctmira.org online service on June 26. It's written by Jessica Harke, and it's titled, Connecticut Child Advocate Alleges Discrimination by Four School Districts. Months after releasing a report regarding an investigation into an alarming lack of oversight of one of the largest special education program providers in Connecticut, the Office of the Child Advocate and Disability Rights Connecticut have filed a related complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice alleging disability discrimination. The complaint alleges several federal special education laws were violated by four school districts, Hartford, Bridgeport, Waterbury, and Stratford. These districts are among those in the state that send their special needs students to High Road Schools, which is described by the groups as a private equity-owned, state-approved, and publicly funded private special education program that serves students with disabilities who may need more individualized attention or require more high-need services than a traditional public school setting can offer. The complaint follows a two-year investigation and report about High Road Schools that claim that hundreds of Connecticut special education students who have attended these schools, which are located in Hartford, New London, Wallingford, and other towns, have been grossly underserved in both educational planning and service delivery. The investigation found that students with disabilities, particularly low-income children from Black and Latino communities, were routinely placed by the districts at the segregated High Road Schools, where they receive substandard and unequal education from often unqualified staff, are regularly subject to seclusion and restraint, and often have no pathway to return to their home schools and districts, according to a news release from the state's Office of the Child Advocate. Sarah Egan, the state's child advocate, said the issues gave rise to concerns of civil rights violations and that her office didn't hear back from most districts about how they were planning to remedy the situation. There are still hundreds of students in a program that just a few months ago we found was not complying with state laws and where children are being and generally poorly served. It's certainly concerning. One of the major concerns we reported on was a lack of oversight for what was happening to the kids, both by the school districts and, frankly, by the State Department of Education. A release from the Office of the Child Advocate claimed the local districts did not exercise their requisite monitoring and oversight in regards to the education provided to their students at the High Road Schools. And State Department of Education failed to oversee the state-approved programs and failed to ensure that students with disabilities were receiving a safe and appropriate education. In response to the Department of Justice complaint, a spokesperson from High Road Schools of Connecticut referred to a statement issued in March when findings from the OCA and DRCT investigation were first released. The final report simply does not accurately reflect the academic and behavioral supports at our schools, which follow state and federal regulations and guidelines. Our programs are based on serving the academic and behavioral needs of our students, making the absence of clinical services referenced throughout the report misleading. We remain committed to collaborating with all stakeholders in the state, including the OCA, DCRT, and CSDE, to ensure the highest standards of education and care for our students. The State Department of Education said it has not yet received details related to the complaint as of Tuesday afternoon, but in March it raised serious concerns about both its methodology and legal assertions. Despite the CSDE's concerns regarding the DRCT-OCA report, we engaged in follow-up supervisory and monitoring activities. We conducted a targeted on-site off-cycle standards review of the High Road schools. These reviews called into question the reliability and accuracy of DRCT-OCA's claims regarding, among other things, staffing credentials and hiring practices within the High Road schools, said Matthew Cerrone, a spokesperson for the department, adding that the OCA did not provide necessary information which would have allowed us to conduct an expansive investigation of the claims contained in the DRCT-OCA's report. This refusal to work in collaboration manner is also at odds with DRCT-OCA's stated concerns for the High Road students. Egan said the Education Department and Office of Child Advocate remain in ongoing dispute about whether the Department of Education met its obligations under the federal special education law. We have not resolved that dispute, so that remains something that has to get resolved, either on the policy level or legally. We look forward to pursuing all remedies available to us, including legal ones, to enforce the civil rights of these children and making sure that there is appropriate policies for students with disabilities. The complaint filed on Tuesday urges the Department of Justice to investigate and remediate the deficiencies identified by DOJ through its investigation. OCA, a state agency, and DRCT, a disability rights nonprofit, investigated the following campuses: High Road School of Hartford Primary Middle, High Road School of Hartford High School, High Road Best Academy of Wallingford, High Road School of Fairfield County in Norwalk, High Road School of New London, and High Road School of Windham County in Killingly. The schools were examined from March 2022 through March 2024 through a series of reviews, educational files, classroom observation, and interviews. About 316 students were enrolled at six of the eight High Road schools in Connecticut during the 21-22 academic year, with the student body being made up of about 80% boys, 70% students of color from across 38 Connecticut school districts. The investigation found that the 21-22 academic year, there were more than 1,200 reports of students being restrained or secluded in High Road schools. The report said several students were subjected to alleged discriminatory practices, including five students from Waterbury Public Schools who were placed at High Road and subjected to 83 total incidents of restraint and 44 total incidents of seclusion. A similar number of restraint and seclusion occurred across campuses in Hartford and Bridgeport, and one Bridgeport student was subjected to 60 incidents of restraint, and more than a third of Bridgeport students were restrained or secluded in 21-22. 80 High Road students, or about 25%, were outsourced from Hartford Public Schools, making the capital city's public school district the largest district consumer of High Road services, according to the report released in March. Almost 30% of those students were subjected to restraint and or seclusion during the 21-22 school year, with eight students subjected to more than 10 instances and two of them subjected to 27 instances or restraint or seclusion. Beyond disproportionate instances of restraint or seclusion, the investigation also found that almost half of the teachers employed at High Road did not have adequate teacher certification from the state of Connecticut or did not undergo proper background checks. The report also highlighted that High Road schools did not offer any documentation of physical education, art, or music teachers, and nurses were not employed at all buildings. Concerns were also raised regarding a persistent and widespread problem of student disengagement and absenteeism, lack of adequate assessments and evaluations to determine student needs, and a lack of an individualized approach to student education. The complaint asked the Department of Justice to ensure that sending school districts take action, providing proper and sufficient special education services in the most integrated setting, and that children attend these schools are entitled to phys ed, art programs, health, and safety. Actions or inactions by the districts during and in response to the OCA DRCT investigative findings have been insufficient to address the chronic and systemic violations of state and federal special education and disability anti-discrimination laws. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on June 26th. It's written by Taylor Hartz, and it's titled, Connecticut Northeast Probate Court is Moving. Connecticut's Northeast Probate Court has moved to a more accessible location in Putnam near the town's municipal buildings, according to officials. Judge of Probate Gabrielle Labonte said this week that the probate court has moved from 508 Pomfret Street to 84 Providence Street, a spot more easily reached by public transportation. The new space is situated in the heart of Putnam, right near the new municipal complex. The move enables us to better accommodate visitors and enhances accessibility, being conveniently located on the public transportation route. The Northeast Probate Court services the towns of Ashford, Brooklyn, Eastford, Pomfret, Putnam, Thompson, and Woodstock. In a statement, Labonte said the court works with families during times of need, with services including placing children with family and friend guardians instead of or in foster care, supporting individuals with intellectual disabilities, supervising the care of folks who need conservators, and assisting older adults who are aging in place in their homes. The court is open from 8:15 to 4:45 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and from 8:15 to 3 p.m. on Friday. The court's phone number remains the same, 860-928-4844. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on June 26. It's written by Ken Goslin, and it's titled, Historic Connecticut Church Building That the State Paid $2.3 million for is Sold for $750,000. A historic but long vacant building on a prominent corner near the state capitol in Hartford will get another life as a church. The structure's original use when it was erected nearly a century ago. Vox Church, a non-denominational church with 11 locations in Connecticut and Southern Mass, announced on Tuesday it had acquired the former Second Church of Christ Scientist at 199 Lafayette Street from the state of Connecticut. The church acquired the building for $750,000, according to church spokesman Dave Bruno. The state paid $2.3 million for the property in 2007 under then-Governor Jody Rell, but the state has never found a viable use for it. The State Department of Administrative Services, which handles sales of state properties, could not immediately be reached for comment. Bruno said he did not have an estimate for what the church intended to invest in much-needed renovations. Architects are now designing the project aimed at a cost-effective renovation that will preserve the historic, architecturally beautiful beauty of the classical and Georgian revival structure and make the four-story building energy efficient. The church expects to occupy the church between 9 and 12 months after renovations begin. The building will serve as a permanent location for Sunday services to accommodate growing attendance in the city, and it also will become a hub to serve the greater Hartford community. The Christian Church began Sunday services at 2016 in Hartford and currently meets at the Infinity Music Hall on Front Street. Vox Church is honored and excited to have a permanent home in the city of Hartford, Vox Church leader Pastor Justin Kendrick said. Our passion is to serve the city and make a positive difference for its residents. Vox is a multi-generational, multicultural church that loves Hartford and wants to see the best for the city. The building will become the church's second anchor location and will serve as a critical central hub for the next phase of the church's growth. The church building was purchased by the state with the intention of using it for archival storage for the adjacent Connecticut State Library and rehearsal space for the Hartford Symphony Orchestra. Plans and funding never appeared, and apart from serving as an emergency homeless shelter in 2009, the building remained vacant. In 2021, the Hartford Preservation Alliance became so concerned about the building's future that the Alliance placed the structure on its list of most endangered properties in the city that year. Vox Church said it is committed to building revitalization efforts and has a proven track record of refurbishing deteriorated vacant buildings, including recent projects in Middletown, Springfield, Brantford, and elsewhere. In the community, Vox Church in Hartford focuses on homelessness, food insecurity, and education. The church has partnered with Connecticut Food Share, Vox Elementary School, South Park Inn, Hands on Hartford, and World Vision. With a permanent facility, the church will now be able to serve as a location for food distribution, citywide service days, school tutoring, a warming center, and addiction recovery groups. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on June 26. It's written by Don Stakem, and it's titled, End of a Little Poland Institution, New Britain's Staropolska is Gone for Good. The Staropolska restaurant, for decades part of the bedrock of New Britain's popular Little Poland section, is officially out of business. After being hit hard by the pandemic and set back even more by a fire last September, the restaurant that many people consider the biggest attraction among Broad Street's 100-plus businesses announced on Tuesday morning it won't reopen. To our many friends and loyal customers, all good things must come to an end, owners Bogdan and Margaret Malinowski announced on Staropolska's Facebook page. It is with heavy heart that we share with you that the other 30 wonderful years of culinary creativity, we have decided not to reopen Staropolska restaurant. The loss was a hard one for Polish food aficionados and Little Poland leaders alike, marking the end of a business that was widely credited with helping the transformation of that part of the city into a regionally famous tourist draw. This was one of the anchors of Little Poland, said Adrian Baron, a local attorney and unofficial head of its usually popular Little Poland Festival. Bogdan and Margaret supported so many local community events and charities. She did a lot of behind-the-scenes work for the festival. This is a real big loss for our community. Mayor Aaron Stewart also had praised for the couple's contribution to New Britain. Over 30 years ago, Margaret and Bogdan became the faces that were associated with Broad Street. They always greeted everyone warmly, and their food was unmatched. I am terribly sad to see this happen this way. State Senator Rick Lopes, a community organizer on Broad Street when Staropolska got its start in the mid-90s, is among the New Britain people hoping a new operator can bring something similar to the same location. Hopefully a new restaurant comes forward to take their place and continue the tradition of good Polish food on Broad Street. When Broad Street was a blighted, crime-plagued part of the city in the mid-90s, Little Poland had almost no recognition outside of Greater New Britain, and Staropolska might never had made a prominent name. But a grassroots anti-crime effort and a massive influx of small businesses made Broad Street a Polish landmark in the United States, and Staropolska achieved fame. Fortune featured it heavily in 2020 profile of Little Poland. Both the New York Times and Boston Globe reviewed it very favorably. The annual Little Poland Festival now draws tens of thousands of people from across the Northeast and even beyond. And Staropolska, like other Broad Street businesses, benefited from the exposure. Places with so much history are irreplaceable, but there is a definitely opportunity to fill the void with another cozy, home-style Polish restaurant in Little Poland, says Derek Barsakowski, honorary Polish consul and a longtime supporter of the Little Poland section. Staropolska was an institution in Little Poland, and its permanent closing is a loss for our neighborhood, the local community, and visitors alike. For many years, Staropolska and its formal rival, Krakowia, were widely considered the top Polish restaurants in the area, each a must for the Polish celebrities and Connecticut politicians who frequently visit. Krakowia relocated to West Main Street in 2016, though, and later shut down. For many longtime residents, the newer Europlate and Belvedere now hold the top honors. When Polish President Andrzej Duda visited the city in 2019, his reception dinner was at the Belvedere. Still, its supporters say Staropolska was the area's undisputed heavyweight champ until the end. Just 2 years ago, though, Stewart held a contest on National Pierogi Day and ended up awarding the Staropolska the Golden Pierogi Trophy. A lot of people consider Staropolska the heart of Little Poland. Staropolska and Belvedere are the two big anchors of the street when it comes to restaurants. Staropolska didn't close because of a shortage of business. They were at the height of their popularity. Dignitaries ate there. Famous Polish musical acts ate there. Tour buses brought people there. My son is only 4, but he's going to be devastated, Baron said. He loved the Polish crepes. He loved the pierogies. I liked going there also. You could see the attorney general or lieutenant governor. You could see a mayor. A lot of judges also ate there. Baron said Little Poland was buoyed after the retirement of the owners of Quo Vadis, a well-known Polish crafts and souvenir store on Broad Street. They have Polish books and music, so much tourist stuff that if you go to Poland and forget to buy souvenirs for people, you could go there and shop and no one would know the difference. We didn't know what would happen when the owners retired. It was taken over by a younger Polish couple who are continuing the tradition. So we're hoping someone will come in and do the same thing at the restaurant. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on June 24th. It's written by Luther Termel, and it's titled, New Haven-based quasi-public regional water authority seeks to buy Aquarian water from Eversource. Officials with South Central Regional Water Authority, New Haven, are preparing a bid to acquire the Aquarian Water Company from Eversource Energy, according to the official with the quasi-public water utility. Kevin Watsey, the Director of Public Affairs for the Regional Water Authority, said, as part of the regional supply strategy, the RWA plans to submit a bid to purchase the Aquarian Water Company. But before that can happen, Connecticut lawmakers must approve legislation that would allow the authority to purchase a utility located outside of its current service territory. That proposed legislation will be considered as part of the special session of the state legislature, which is scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday. The authority was created by similar legislation in 1977 when Connecticut lawmakers created the quasi-public utility. 3 years later, the RWA acquired the assets of the for-profit New Haven Water Company, which has fallen into financial difficulties. Watsey said the acquisition of Aquarian would enable the RWA to provide improved economies of scale, operational efficiencies, a broader focus on customer service and a community support, as well as lower cost of capital, access to broader customer base for commercial offerings to reduce water rate increases, and access to a deep and talented pool of individuals living within the region. The quasi-public utility has a successful 44-year track record that demonstrates the benefits of government ownership, local control, and regulation and organizational stability with public control. Some of the significant proposed changes to the RWA's enabling legislation include the establishment of a new water authority, mirroring the RWA as a quasi-public utility, including changes to the board governance structure. Watsey declined to say how much the RWA is prepared to pay for Aquarian, saying only that at this time, we are continuing to advance financial details on our bid to purchase AWC. Aquarian's corporate parent, Eversource Energy, announced in February that it was looking to sell the water company, which has about 236,000 customers in 72 cities and towns in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. The utility serves 59 towns in Connecticut, whereas 215,000 household and business customers, mostly in Fairfield and Litchfield counties. The South Central Regional Water Authority serves 15 communities and has 117,000 customers. Peter Fazekas, a spokesman for Aquarian, said on Monday that officials with that company have no update at this point of the potential sale of their utility. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on June 25th. It's written by Lise Klein, and it's titled, How the CDK Cyber Attack is Affecting Connecticut Car Dealerships. Opt for the luxury package with your new Lexus NX at David McDermott Lexus in New Haven, and you'll get the latest in high-tech touchscreens, cloud navigation, and triple-beam LED headlights. But this week, your salesperson may place your order via a handwritten form. We're going back to the old-school ways of doing things and doing things like we did in the 1990s before we had all these great computer software systems, said Kevin Siambathy, Executive General Manager at Dave McDermott Auto Group. McDermott is one of an estimated 15,000 car dealerships nationwide dealing with a crippling cyber attack that has pulled the plug on the brains of their operations. Monday was the sixth day that dealerships have been shut out of a crucial dealer management system platform provided by CDK Global after the company was hit by a reported ransomware attack. CDK Global Systems automate and link everything from customer data to showroom inventory to parts ordering, and has forced major businesses like McDermott to go back to pre-digital systems to operate. The company confirmed the attack last week and said it would be providing regular updates until the problems were resolved. Other Connecticut car dealers have not been spared by the disruption, according to Sarah Frixell, president of the Connecticut Automotive Retailers Association. A number of Connecticut's franchise new car dealerships continue to be impacted by the CDK Global shutdown. Despite this disruption, these dealerships have pivoted in order to accommodate customers and conduct business and remain open as the issue is worked out. Frixell said the association did not know the numbers. CDK Global's platform is so widespread that the Texas-based company estimates on its website that 2.6% of the entire U.S. gross domestic product is transacted through its system, a share estimated at $735 billion as of the first quarter of this year. Five major North American auto dealers have notified the U.S. Securities and Exchange System that the cyber attack may impact their earnings in recent days, according to Bloomberg News. The crisis has transfixed the dealership industry with a banner headline and eight related stories on the homepage of the Automotive News website, including a timeline of the cyber attack on CDK Global. Bloomberg has attributed the attack to a ransomware outfit called Black Suit and said that CDK Global is likely in the process of negotiating with the hackers. Even if a deal is struck and customer data is kept offline, the industry could take months to recover. Ciambathy said that McDermott is still selling lots of compact SUVs like the Lexus NX as the summer car buying season ramps up. But along with other dealerships nationwide, McDermott is struggling to make do without the software brains of its operation. The East Haven dealership disconnected from CDK Global platform as soon as it was notified of the attack, just to make sure there was no possible exposure on our end. Since then, paper forms have been deployed to order parts, keep track of inventory, and schedule service. I guess our biggest issues with the system being down is the parts and service, just communications between everything was done through that system. But as befits a business that boasts of the largest American flag in New England flying over its Chevy dealership, McDermott is forging ahead. After disruptions like COVID-19 pandemic, Ciambathy and his employees are used to adapting to difficult circumstances. We're doing it through older systems that get the job done. You know, it's just another bump in the road, another adjustment to make, and we just keep on keeping on. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on June 24th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, Connecticut Officials Applaud Supreme Court Rejection of Challenge to Connecticut Vaccination Exemption Law. The United States Supreme Court on Monday rejected a challenge to a 2021 Connecticut law that eliminated the state's longstanding religious exemption from childhood immunization requirements for schools, colleges, and daycare facilities. The justices did not comment in leaving in place a federal appeals court ruling that upheld the contentious law. The lower court judge had earlier dismissed the lawsuit challenging the law, which drew protest at the state capitol. Connecticut law requires students to receive certain immunizations before enrolling in school, allowing some medical exemptions. Prior to 2021, students also could seek religious exemptions. Lawmakers ended the religious exemptions over concerns that an uptick in exemption requests was coupled with a decline in vaccination rates in some schools. The change allowed current students in K-12 who already had a religious exemption to keep it. Senate President Martin Looney, Democrat from New Haven, and Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff, Democrat from Norwalk, said in response to the ruling, by closing a loophole for non-medical vaccine exemptions, Connecticut embraced a common-sense vaccination policy that protects the health and safety of all students. This law has now withstood legal scrutiny at every level of our judicial system, and its perseverance represents a victory for parents and students who are less likely to be infected by preventable illnesses. Further, Attorney General William Tong said, this is the end of the road to a challenge to Connecticut's life-saving and fully lawful vaccine requirements. We have said all along, and the courts have affirmed, the legislature acted responsibly and well within its authority to protect the health of Connecticut families and to stop the spread of preventable disease. Tong also noted that only one part of the case now remains active, involving a single plaintiff's claim based on the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The Office of the Attorney General is confident that the IDEA claim will be dismissed by the district court on remand. A group that has challenged other vaccination laws, including COVID-19, sued. We, the Patriots USA, Inc., and several parents argued that Connecticut violated religious freedom protections by removing the exemption. The new law allows hostility to religious believers and jeopardizes their rights to medical freedom and child rearing, they said in court papers. Tong also said Connecticut law requires students receiving certain immunizations before enrolling in school. Prior to 2021, students could apply for medical or religious exemptions to that requirement. Public Act 21-6 eliminated the religious exemption while grandfathering students in kindergartens through grade 12 who had already received such exemptions. Our next article was posted to the ctmira.org online service on June 24th. It's written by Jenna Carlesso, and it's titled, Connecticut is Considering Health Plan Rate Increases. The Connecticut Insurance Department is again considering annual rate hikes for state-regulated health plans on and off insurance exchange. Insurers are seeking an average increase of 8.3% in 2025 individual plans and a 12% on small group policies. The proposed hikes are lower than what was requested the last 2 years, but similar to those sought in 2021. Last year, insurers asked for an average rate increase of 12% on individual plans and 15% on small group plans. The state approved a 9.4% average hike for individual policies and 7.4% for the small group plans. The plans collectively cover about 200,000 people. Attorney William Tong said residents can't keep paying higher rates. I will closely scrutinize each of these requests and expect to play a very active role in every step of the process. Connecticut families and small businesses cannot continue to absorb these increases year after year. The burden of proof will fall on the insurers to justify every penny. Decisions here will have an enormous impact on the cost of health care for every one of us. Here's what to know about the proposed rate hikes. How much of an increase are insurers requesting for plans on the exchange? Three carriers are selling policies through the state's health insurance exchange known as Access Health CT, Anthem Health Plans, Connecticut Care Benefits, and Connecticut Care Insurance Company. Anthem is seeking an average increase of 9%. Depending on the plan and coverage, 63,000 people are impacted. It's also requested an average increase of 14% on small group policies that cover about 38,000 people. Connecticut Care Benefits is asking for an average hike of 7.4% on individual plans. The increases range from 6.4% to 9% and cover 73,000 residents. Connecticut Care Insurance sought a 12.5% average hike on individual policies, which range of 10.8% to 15% that covers 4,400 people. Insurers are also asking for increases on off-exchange policies. So what happens next? The insurance department actuaries will review the request for increases. As part of their review, they will look at trends in unit costs, utilization of services, expected severity of claims. The department will issue questions to the insurers and seek clarification if needed. After that, the department can choose to approve the full requested increase, rejecting them, or amend them. The final changes will be published later this summer. Why are the insurers seeking such increases? Insurance companies have attributed the proposed rate hikes to increased demand for medical services, rising health care costs, the impact of Medicaid unwinding, the expiration of pandemic policy that prevented states from kicking people off Medicaid, and adjustments needed to reflect the COVID expenses in 2025 at a level higher than previously assumed. Will the public have any chance to weigh in on these decisions? Residents can post comments online by clicking select under each rate proposal, or they can mail letters to the Connecticut Insurance Department at P.O. Box 816, Hartford, Connecticut. A public hearing will be held later this summer at a date yet to be announced. When does the open enrollment start? You can expect it to start beginning November 1st. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on June 23rd. It's written by Pam McLaughlin, and it's titled, Connecticut Woman Seeks Justice for Crash That Paralyzed Her. A young Connecticut woman paralyzed in a car accident 5 years ago has won hearts and donations from across the country because of her resilience and positivity. But Gabby Murillo hasn't found justice. The man who hit the car she was in, allegedly at 95 miles per hour, was not criminally charged, although he admitted on police body cam video that he had been drinking at a club that night. Murillo has also had ongoing obstacles in her effort to get civil damages to pay for the 24-hour care she requires. Murillo's back was broken and her spinal cord severed. She is paralyzed from her shoulders down. Her journey for justice, full of twists, has now been documented in a short film by three filmmakers from Murillo's hometown of West Haven. I think it's awesome, Murillo said of the finished product. I think it really ties in the main point of how he, the man who hit the car she was in and allegedly got through the loopholes. The film entitled Injustice, the Gabby Murillo Story, takes aim at the Florida Highway Patrol, a alleging an insufficient investigation. The film was directed and created by brother filmmakers Joseph Massa, 34, Christian Massa, 32, and their aunt, Michelle Massa, who was also executive producer. The trio worked on the film for 3 years as the case made its way through the courts and includes riveting footage of the driver being interviewed at the scene on police body cam footage. We wanted to make sure we took the time for things to play out. I wanted to make sure we presented it fairly. The Florida Highway Patrol has heavily criticized the film. The Current sought comments from the agency. Lieutenant Jim Buford, Chief of Public Affairs for the Florida Highway Patrol, wrote in an email response to a request for a comment, "We do not have anyone available for interviews to this story." Michelle Massa said she believes the justice system and police system failed Gabby, and anything that could go wrong did. The civil case is still ongoing, and Michelle Massa is hoping the film may spark an expert out there to find a new creative approach for getting justice. The trauma for Murillo and her family started June 16, 2019, and gained national media attention because of the personal details. Murillo was 3 weeks into her dream internship at Disney World, one it took 3 tries to land. The youngest of 4 girls, Gabby Murillo, now 27, was sitting in the passenger seat of a car parked off the side of 408 Highway in Orlando. The friend was in the driver's seat, and it's not clear why they had pulled over. A rental car driven by a man whom the Current isn't naming because he hasn't been charged, allegedly barreled into the parked car at 95 miles an hour, and according to the eyewitnesses, pushed the car 150 feet into a wall. The car went 5 feet off the ground and twisted before landing. Murillo had to be extracted by emergency responders. Police interviewed the suspect, and he told them, as recorded on body cam footage, that all part of the film, that he allegedly had been at a club and had been 3 or 4 drinks and another substance. Later in the footage, he changes his story, including about whether he was driving. State police in Florida sent him to the hospital. They allegedly didn't conduct a field sobriety test or order a blood alcohol test. The man was issued a ticket for reckless driving, but not criminally charged. The reckless driving ticket was thrown out of court. Meanwhile, Murillo underwent months of hospitalization and rehab to be left paralyzed. She needs 24-hour care to survive, unable to even scratch an itch or brush her teeth. Joseph Massa said the film can't be aired publicly yet because they are entering it in the film festival circuit. A draft of the 20-minute film was reviewed privately by the Current. The film showcases a Florida law on accident report privilege, which protects drivers and passengers that are involved in car accidents from having their statements used against them in civil or criminal court. In the film, they call it crash privilege. The privilege, also present in other states, is intended to align with the Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. It complicates Murillo's quest for justice because nothing on the body cam footage at the accident site can be used in the case. "I thought the body cam was evidence," Murillo said, noting she is hoping to get that law changed for future victims. The film also brings to light a federal law, the Graves Amendment, which says rental car companies cannot be held liable for accidents caused by customers. That meant Murillo couldn't go after them civilly. The driver was using a car he rented. A Florida lawyer representing the Murillo family estimates in the film that it will cost $15 million to $20 million over Murillo's lifetime to provide the proper care. Right now, she has Medicaid, Medicare, and the love of her family. The driver had minimal insurance with about a $200,000 cap, according to the film. The lawyer filed a civil suit against the driver, but the day before a court hearing was to start, he filed for bankruptcy. That case is still going through the court process. Murillo's mom, Amanda Murillo, said before the incident, her daughter was always going, going, going. Murillo's new normal is painting butterflies and images by holding a paintbrush in her mouth. In a poignant scene in the film, Murillo tears up, saying sometimes she feels like a burden and that she always feels rushed during times like getting in and out of the car. Murillo told the Current she closely follows clinical trials and research in the spinal cord injury realm, and she remains hopeful of a cure will soon be found. "I still want to get up in the morning, get out of bed, and do things. I appreciate life." The filmmakers are in awe that despite it all, Murillo was always smiling. Michelle Massa said she's floored that Gabby has maintained such a positive attitude. She described Gabby as having a great sense of humor, incredible patience, and as a person who sees the bright side and wants others to see it also. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on June 25th. It's written by a variety of staff, and it's titled, "The Claim Was Discrimination Against a Connecticut Child with Autism and Diabetes." The federal government has entered a settlement agreement with a Connecticut provider of therapy and therapeutic services for children to resolve claims the company discriminated against a child with autism spectrum disorder and type 1 disabilities. The allegation was that Creative Interventions, a private company in Windsor, refused to monitor the child's continuous glucose monitor or to provide other routine diabetes care while the child attended the program. A message seeking comment was left with Creative Interventions, but they did not respond. Authorities said Creative Interventions provides applied behavior analysis therapy and other therapeutic services for children with autism spectrum disorder in private homes, public schools, and at its Windsor business, while there was a drop-off program for young children. Some of the services are provided as part of the state's Birth to Three program, according to the federal authorities. Authorities said the matter was initiated by a complaint filed in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Connecticut by the Center for Children's Advocacy on behalf of the parents of a child with type 1 diabetes who was enrolled at the Creative Interventions Achievement. The complaint was that after the child was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, staff at the business allegedly refused to provide the child's diabetes-related care and instead required a parent to come to the clinic to provide the care. Among other things, the child's diabetes management plan requires a caregiver to monitor a CGM, which shows the child's blood sugar levels, and requires a caregiver to be prepared to address high or low blood sugar readings by providing a fast-acting carbohydrate of glucagen or insulin. Following an investigation, the government alleged that Creative Interventions discriminated against the child and the child's parents in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act by refusing to have its staff provide this routine diabetes care to the child. The government found that monitoring the child's CGM and providing the other routine diabetes care specified by the child's care plan, including the administration of insulin and glucagen, were reasonable modifications under the ADA that Creative Intervention staff should have provided with proper training. Further, under terms of the settlement agreement, Creative Interventions has agreed not to discriminate against children with disabilities in the future. Creative Interventions will also implement new policies and procedures for handling requests for reasonable modifications that are consistent with the ADA and will provide training to its staff on the ADA. As part of the settlement, authorities said Creative Interventions also agreed that where a child's parents and healthcare team consent, it's not non-medical staff will obtain training and provide routine diabetes care for children with type 1 diabetes, including monitoring a child's CGM, administering glucagen and insulin if necessary, as reasonable modifications under the ADA. Federal authorities also said Creative Interventions agreed to pay $15,000 to the complainant in this matter. Children with diabetes and their families are entitled to equal access to child care and health care, said U.S. Attorney Vanessa Roberts Avery. I thank Creative Interventions for cooperating with our investigation and agreeing to comply with the ADA going forward. The settlement agreement is effective for 3 years, and the U.S. Attorney's Office will monitor compliance. Our next article was posted to the Town of East Hartford online service on June 23rd. It's written by Stephen Good, and it's titled, "Former Stone Academy Owner Speaks Up About the Student Loan Scandal." For much of his adult life, Mark Scheinberg has found ways to get things done with what he thought were the best of intentions, even if they were considered outside the box. And that was the case a few years ago with making student loan payments for Stone Academy nursing students who, he said, were victims of predatory private student loan services. Scheinberg, 68, owned the now closed-for-profit school for nursing, said he was not involved in the day-to-day operations when he learned that some private loan service companies were holding on to payments in order to force students to default. He said he started making anonymous payments by mail in their names to keep them current. He said he did it to protect the students. "We think about the students' needs," he said. "That's who we report to." But the federal government's law saw it differently. The Department of Justice said he did it to hide default rates. Between 2015 and 2019, the government said Scheinberg paid back student loans to hide his college's cohort default rate from the Department of Education, according to a settlement with the Department of Justice in 2022. According to the settlement, Scheinberg made 154 payments via himself and Stone Academy, sending money orders to loan servicers on behalf of 102 Stone Academy students. His goal, the Department of Justice said, was to prevent the students from falling into default, which would have raised the college's cohort default rate, the share of federal loan borrowers who default with a certain time period. When he was approached by investigators about what he did, Scheinberg, who was the founder and president of Goodwin University in East Hartford, said he admitted to making those payments and why. Eventually, Scheinberg agreed to a settlement with the government that included a $1 million fine and an agreement to step down as the president of Goodwin in 5 years, sell Stone Academy and Pyre School of Art, and step down from his position on the Board of Trustees at the University of Bridgeport, which Goodwin bought in 2021. The biggest mistake I ever made was writing those checks, Scheinberg said, but it never crossed my mind that it would look at any different way. Scheinberg said the default rate only decreased by 1 percentage point as a result of his actions, but prosecutors noted that the default rate of 15% was more than double the national average in 2018, and that prospective students used the number to determine if they can find a job in their field after graduation in order to continue to pay their loans. As Goodwin was in the midst of celebrating its 25th anniversary as an accredited school of higher learning, Scheinberg reflected this week on the stewardship of the university, which started out in a storefront on Burnside Avenue in East Hartford. "We're coming up on 100,000 graduates with jobs," he said. "That's our legacy." Goodwin also has magnet schools for students with pre-K through high school and has been approved by the state to build another one. But Scheinberg is worried about his good work will be overshadowed by the mistake of the student loan payments. He is hopeful that he can continue on beyond the remaining 2.5 years to retirement as stipulated in the settlement. "If they'll allow me, I'll take another 5 years. I don't want to retire under these circumstances." That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about the articles read today or about other programs offered by Chris, please call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. This is Peter. So long till next time.